In a BBC Two documentary that was broadcast last night, he claims he was a spy. The documentary was called The Secret Life of Uri Geller, Psychic Spy. And he came into the studio to tell me about his alleged ties to the Mossad and CIA. He was talking to me about his early life in Israel, how he dealt with fame and about those alleged spy revelations. But first of all, how could I let him forget about the very first time I spoke to Uri when we didn't exactly get off on the right foot?
Stephen, it's such a pleasure to be with you because we met about 10 or 11 years ago. You interviewed me in Ireland and you still are a superstar there, well, I hear.
People will be thinking you're absolutely mad listening to this, calling me a superstar. There are some stories that certainly people listening to this program won't know, Uri, before we get into about you, that is actually fascinating, the dynamic between you and I. I certainly find it so. Do you know, you won't remember this because, of course, you're traveling around the world. The very first day I went into the BBC, in BBC Northern Ireland, and people still talk about this story, I was this kind of mad radio presenter, didn't really know the BBC, didn't know how I should behave. And my first ever interview, day one, was with Uri Geller, who slammed down the phone, hung up on me because I was too rude.
That was you. No way.
That's right. And I've still got it on tape. And I was interviewing you and you said, I'm not taking this. And down went the phone. And I started to wise up after that moment.
How interesting. And I do remember it. You know why? Honestly, this is true. I have a vision in my mind that I'm walking, was it Belfast or where was it? I'm walking in the city in a cobbled street and someone told me that I shouldn't have slammed the phone or something. Yeah. I do remember that. And look, here we are again.
11 years
together,
later.
11 years later.
It is lovely to talk to you. You're an enigma. And I want to start off by talking about the documentary, first of all, because everything can flow from there. This is The Secret Life of Uri Geller, Psychic Spy. What's secret about you?
Well, you know, Stephen, for 40 years, I've been entertaining the world. Today I call myself a mystifier because I certainly mystified a lot of people out there, millions. But I'm also hugely controversial. You know, there's those who don't believe in me. They think it's all trickery and chemicals and sleight of hand and all that. But that's great because I'm a master publicist. I'm kind of boasting now and I'm shamelessly saying it, that I'm a super publicist. So I knew how to take that controversy and make it work for me to boost my career. So there's no such thing as bad publicity. As long as I spell your name correctly, then it's always good. You know, Oscar Wilde said, there's only one worse thing in life than being talked about. And that's not being talked about. So everybody knew me for the spoon bending, for the mind reading, for the quirky Uri Geller, for the bizarre Uri Geller, the strange. And I loved that because that was my inbuilt safety device while I was doing my other work, the dark work. And if you ask me what that was...
Well, this dark work, I don't know whether to believe it or not, because you're now claiming to have been a spy.
Well, I'll tell you what, you will... Most of the people who hear us now, when they watch BBC Two at 9 o'clock, right after Top Gear, I have a feeling that most of the viewers will be convinced, because the director of this documentary, a man called Vikram Jayanti, I don't know how he did it. He's an Oscar winner. And when the BBC asked me to do a documentary on my secret life, I said, nobody will ever find out anything. But Vikram, with an Oscar under his wing, with his charisma, charm, and personality and character, managed to somehow penetrate the minds of the people who used to handle me or tested me decades ago, and they just talked. I was shocked when I saw this documentary, The Secret Life of Uri Geller, because I didn't know some of the things that were revealed in this film. And if you're home tomorrow, I really urge you to see it, not because it's about me, because of the revelations in it. Now, you won't believe this, but I was asked, for instance, to brainwash and bombard the Russian Yuli Voronsov, who was the head of the nuclear arms reduction treaty, to sign the nuclear treaty. Yeah, I mean, yeah. When
we might fall out like we did 11 years ago.
No,
right?
No, never. But not again.
But you're such a spoofer.
Well, I call me whatever you. I don't care anymore what
like
people.
You're telling me you were asked to brainwash this guy.
Not only brainwash, but telepathically bombard his head to sign the arms reduction, the nuclear arm reduction treaty. And I'll tell you what, this secret meeting was arranged in London. And the one of the people who came to brief me was no other than Ambassador Max Kempelman, who actually got the Medal of America from the president. And I knew that no one will believe me, so I arranged someone to take a picture of that meeting. And I told him, you've got to capture me shaking this man's hand, because 20 or 30 years from now, no one will believe. And I got these pictures. They're actually in the documentary. But I always said no to dark things that I was asked to do, very negative things. I said, no way.
Were you asked to assassinate people?
Well, not directly assassinate, but one of the experiments was just harrowing. I was led into a room. I will not tell you which country, and I will not reveal to you by which agency.
Why not?
No, because there are certain things I can't tell.
Why?
Because I can't. There are certain confidentiality things that I signed, and ethically I can't reveal. But I was led into a room, listen to this, a white room, by a scientist. And in the middle of the room stood a pig, a big white pig. There was a table and a chair in the room. And the scientist looks at me and he says, Uri, I'm going out for lunch. You stay here. And by the time I come back, I want the pig dead. Dead. Now,
how do you kill a pig?
You know, a pig has a very similar heart to a human being. And that's when I was shattered by that request. First of all, I love animals and I'm a vegetarian. But that's when I realized that, hey, I wonder who is really the target of this experiment. I do only positive things.
Did you kill the pig?
No. I ran out of the experiment. You know, Ken Russell did a movie about me years ago called Mindbender. And there is a scene where I'm being asked to do this. And he, you know, Ken Russell with his fantastic imagination created an incredible scene in the movie of me. I wasn't, you know, there was an actor playing me running out of the experimental room. But just recently, and this is a positive thing, stop me when you think I talk too much. I was asked to, by the head of the Israeli Red Cross, which is called Magen David Adom, they asked me to get the Palestine Red Crescent. Now, this is the Palestinians who are fighting Israel all the time for 60 years. And to help the Palestinian Red Crescent and the Israeli Magen David Adom to get them into the International Red Cross, because the head of the Israeli Red Cross, Magen David Adom, saw me in a documentary talking about how I do these mind brain washing things. And he said, the only person that can do it is Uri Geller. And for 3 years, Stephen, I flew to the State Department, to Korea, to the president of Switzerland. And at the last meeting, I saw that it goes nowhere. The Palestinians were arguing with the Israelis. And I looked at the foreign minister, the Swiss foreign minister, and I told her, can you tell your waiter to bring a spoon? And everyone kind of stopped. There was dead silence in the room. And the waiter brings in a spoon, and I pick it off the tray. And of course, you know, I bend the spoon, and everyone freaks out. And then I hand the spoon into the hands of the Palestinian negotiator, and the spoon continues bending. Everyone is so shocked and amazed they signed the deal. They signed the agreement. And now Israel and Palestine have been accepted into the International Red Cross. Now, of course, I didn't do this alone, but it's just an example of what some entertainment and showmanship can do. I promised my mother when I was 7 years old, because we were so poor, we lived in a one-room apartment. My father left my mother. He was a womanizer. My mother struggled, and I promised her that I'll make it. I'll buy her a television set. I told her, I'll get you a black and white TV.
When you were how old?
I was about 7 or 8 years old.
And you remember saying that to your mom?
Of course. I told her I'll get her a dishwasher. Dishwashers were almost unheard of in Israel then. Only very rich people had them. Television, come on. We had to go 5 blocks to a neighbor's window to peep in to watch TV. And I promised my mother that. And I did it. I made it because I had this urge to be successful.
Let me go back to when you were that child, age 7. And you've got this drive to be successful, to do well by your mom. Now, that's fair enough. But how does that translate to what you then went on to do? What was the first break for you?
Oh, it was BBC, the David Dimbleby. Yeah. You're talking about the show business side.
Yeah.
Oh, 1972. Yeah. David Dimbleby heard about the experiments I was doing at Stanford Research Institute that was financed by the CIA. And he calls me up and says, oh, my name is David Dimbleby. I didn't know who he was. And could you come to England to do my show? I said, I'd love to come to England. And there I found myself on this set with professors, John Taylor and Lyle Watson and David Dimbleby. And I lifted up a spoon or a fork and I said to people at home, go and get your spoons, go and get your forks. I'll bend them in your homes. And the BBC's telephone system blew up because so many spoons were bending in people's homes that the system couldn't take it then. And that was a first break.
But when did you develop that technique, stroke ability, stroke special power, whatever it is?
I think I was born with it. My mother always believed that I inherited it from Sigmund Freud because my mother is a Freud.
And do you know what's confusing for me here?
What?
It's the showman that I know you are and me not wanting to be stupid, taking everything in that you're saying. And that's what, because you're a likable character, you're charismatic, I'm drawn to you.
Yeah.
So is everyone else.
But that's a part of my success.
And yet you're saying that you've been born with these crazy powers.
Yeah. And look, let me do this.
You're playing us all for a fool.
No. This is serious stuff because the mind is very powerful and I'm not unique. I think everybody has some level of intuition. I'll tell you another secret thing that came out directly from the mouth of the president of the United States. There are people who are called remote viewers who can send their mind through space and time. Do we still have time here?
Oh, yeah. We have loads of time.
And a Russian plane crashed in Zaire and the satellites couldn't pick up the plane because it crashed under the canopy of the jungle. And, you know, satellites can't penetrate clouds and jungle and so on. And the Americans wanted the plane because it was loaded with secrets. And they said, we got to get the plane first. So they called in people who are called remote viewers. And this was top secret. And the remote viewers found the plane. They drew out where it was. And the Americans got to the plane first. Now, this was highly top secret. And then the President Carter finishes his presidency. And he goes on a university lecture tour. And a young student gets up and says to him, President Carter, did anything weird or strange happen while you were the president? And he said, let me think. Oh, yes. A Russian plane crashed and a psychic found it. Wow. That was before the Freedom of Information Act kicked in. And there were really strange things happening in the department of the clock and dagger arm.
How does it work, these powers?
Well, I'll show you. When I walked in here, I asked you to do a secret drawing. And you have to admit that I haven't seen it, No one saw it. Is that correct?
Absolutely correct. And listen, let me tell you, if I was in any way encouraged by Uri Geller to be part of a con job, here's what I would do. I would tell you all, I'd sell that story to the papers.
Exactly.
And I'd make more money out of interviewing him tonight.
Now,
so this was completely legit.
Now, I can't guarantee that this is going to work, but it might. Everybody at home, if you can, quickly grab a piece of paper and a pen. Because if I get the drawing, I will transmit it to you. And then you'll call up Stephen later and say that you got it.
0500 909 693.
I'm taking it. Where is your hidden drawing? Are you?
It's in my shirt pocket,
up here.
Okay. I've folded it.
Now look into my eyes.
Yes.
And think of the drawing. And I will. Don't close your eyes. I won't close my eyes. But I will start drawing what I feel coming from you, from your brain into my brain. I'm now drawing. What happens in my mind is I visualize a TV screen into which I have to see your drawing. Honestly, don't take this seriously for a moment, Stephen, and really visualize the drawing that you have drawn. And I ask you to draw anything, so it could be anything. And I'm getting something. I might not be correct. If I'm not correct, I'll admit it on air because it doesn't work all the time. But I'm getting something and I got it. I've drawn something on the piece of paper and I'll show you in a moment. But before I show you, I'm now transmitting it to everybody at home. And I'm actually saying the name of this drawing in my mind. I'm going to say 1, 2, 3 and I'll say the name. You take your pen and you draw it. Everybody at home, here goes. 1, 2, 3 It's a... I said it in my mind telepathically. One more time. 1, 2, 3 It's a... I said it. Draw it now, everybody at home. And now I'm going to reveal what it is and you will reveal your drawing. As a matter of fact, how do you want me to do it? To turn it around and show you?
I'm deeply worried here because if you get it's going to be embarrassing. And
for
if
me,
you get
it's going
right,
to be embarrassing.
It's going to freak me out.
Okay, so this is... I'm showing you first my drawing. That's what I got. A house. Say something.
It is absolutely a house.
Let me see it.
Look. Now that
exactly, I got it. Look,
that is astonishing.
But wait, it's not finished yet.
Astonishing.
Wait,
now,
Stephen.
Hold on. You shut up for 1 second now, sir. You hold on just one moment. No, one moment.
Yeah.
One moment. Now, I'm telling everybody right now, here's how serious I am about this. I love my mother to bits. She is so special to me on this planet. I swear on my mother's life that he did not know and that I drew a house.
Now, wait, I have to now show you something that will blow your mind even more. You drew this, right, with your own hand?
Yes, I did.
I drew this with my own hand. Now, watch this. The drawing is millimetric. I put two lines next to the house on my drawing and your drawing, and now I'm going to put it together. Now, if that's not millimetric, then I don't know what is.
Oh, my goodness. So the exact width.
Can I just show it to them behind the window?
The exact width of the house that I drew is what, and he didn't see it, is exactly the same width as what he drew with his own hand.
And this is not some magic pad. This is not, I asked your assistant to bring in the paper. So there it is. So you see that. Also, by the way, also the window should be millimetric. That should also be millimetric. Here.
By millimetric, you mean exactly
the
same
dimension.
Size. Exactly now the same
I'm
size.
Now I'm going to put the window one on the
and
other.
He's matching them, and they
Look
are.
Look at that.
How do you do that? Tell me.
It's extrasensory perception. What it is, I'll explain you. Now, hang on. To the skeptics, yeah? Magicians can do it with a trick if they bring in copy paper and their pads and all that, or mirrors.
You never had sight of that paper, and you never actually put your hands in the paper, and I know you didn't.
No,
have
this
sight
is
of
real.
It.
Now let me explain you what I believe is happening.
You see, until this moment.
And by the way, you could have drawn a tree, or a flower, or a star, or a circle, or a cross, or a bicycle, or anything.
See, my house is actually very important to me in my life because it's where I relax, and that's why I drew it. until this very point, and you'll probably walk out of here maybe not liking me, I don't know. To this very point,
I thought you were a very good showman, yeah,
but a very good con man.
Okay.
Now, I've completely changed my mind and I'm
thank you. That's sweet of you and it's I'm flattered and I'm honored. Now, now you understand when the Americans... hold on, this is important. The Americans didn't... The CIA didn't test me like this. This is not under laboratory controlled conditions. They locked me in shielded rooms. And it's in the documentary, they locked me in shielded rooms and they did drawings miles away from me. No one drawing, but dozens and dozens and dozens. I was sitting in a shielded room. It's called a Faraday cage, where no eavesdropping can get in. Nobody can say that somebody's transmitting me the drawing. Or, do you understand? The shielded room is, you can't penetrate. And I got every drawing. And the BBC got hold of that film. I don't know how, but that's going to be shown tomorrow. I'm much younger then, with long black hair and all that. But it's just fascinating. And when they saw that, then they realized that I can be used. And when I told you that I went to Geneva to bombard the Russian to sign the nuclear arms reduction treaty, that's what I did, but vice versa. I got very close to him. I had to be 3 inches from his head. So I got behind him and got my head really close to him. And instead you thinking of a house, I said to him, sign, 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 sign. And he signed. They signed.
Are you suggesting that what you're doing is that you are transmitting messages through the air?
You can. Absolutely. Because look, it's really scientific. And will you allow me to say why? In 1924, Albert Einstein wrote an equation, a mega equation. He wrote E equals MC squared, if you remember it from school, with which he proved to the world scientifically now, not mumbo jumbo, paranormal or psychic phenomena, it's science. He proved that everything in the universe is made from energy. You, me, this table here, you can hear me knock on it. That's not solid. This table, Stephen, is energy. It's vibrating in a certain frequency that for us, we feel that it's solid. But he also went to prove that energy cannot be destroyed. Now, what you did for me a few minutes ago, when you thought, when you visualized the house and the window, you're transmitting that to me. You can't see it. It's an invisible wave. I don't really know what it is, but I assume that it must be some sort of a wave. Now, I nurtured this ability since I was a child, so I mastered it. I exercised it to a point where I can kind of demonstrate it on command.
But if you can do that at will, then you can know what we're all thinking, even our private thoughts.
No, I cannot read...
Which must get quite sexy for you at times.
Well, yeah, but I cannot read entire thoughts, Stephen. I can't. I'm not a miracle worker or some kind of... guru, and I do little things that rather trivial things. I can't believe that I'm still around after 42 years from that David Dimbleby show with a rather very narrow repertoire of spoon bending, mind reading, stopping the Big Ben, and so on. But it always fascinated tens of millions of people around the world.
Why do you think, how do you think that is? Because you don't have a manager, you don't have an agent.
No.
So you're creating this aura around yourself.
Yeah, I'm a master of publicity. And I'm saying that, I'm using the word shamelessly again, because I've been attacked a million times by skeptics worldwide. But they...
Does it hurt when they do that?
When I'm being libeled, because Michael Jackson was a really close friend, and I was libeled quite a few times. But if you call me a magician, or I don't really care anymore. I've done it. In a way I made it, you know. I mean, but to answer your question is, well, no, what was your question?
The question was, you create this aura right around yourself, and some, what, 4 decades later, it's still ticking.
Because
it's
I go working with a flow. I believe that if you reinvent yourself, Like you probably did that in your career. I knew how to reinvent myself. When I was young, I called myself a psychic. Then I called myself a paranormalist. Now I call myself a mystifier.
But there's a part of this business, Uri, that is vacuous as well. Part of showbiz that kind of, you know, there are a lot of idiots in showbiz. There are a lot of false people in showbiz. Mm-hmm. Do you not tire of it?
No, I'm a showman. I'm an entertainer.
You still love getting on the stage?
Absolutely. I'm an entertainer. I've created one of the biggest successful formats that I've been now 8 years. The successor. In some countries, it's called Phenomenon. In America, on NBC, it was Phenomenon. In other countries, it's called the new Uri Geller, the next Uri Geller. And I did that 8.5 years ago. And I look back and I say, my gosh, how did I do it? It's just, it's a phenomenon, I believe, my longevity. But because I'll tell you what it is, and a lot of people can learn from this. First of all, I want to tell you something important. When I get 300 emails a day because my email is on my website. When teenagers email me, oh, Mr. Geller, teach me how to bend a spoon. My message is this, forget spoon bending. Instead, focus on school. Become a positive thinker, create a target goal to go to university, never ever smoke, don't touch drugs, and think of success. That's what I do today. I motivate people. But I think that being nice to others, Stephen, being open to others. When I walked into the BBC, there were four people at the reception and they had a fork. And I bent it for them and I signed. Because you've got to be nice to people. Because that doesn't cost money. And being nice to people will come back to you.
You look incredibly fit. Mm-hmm. Do you train a lot? Do you exercise
a lot. I exercise every day. I'm not obsessed. I used to be obsessed. I was bulimic for a year.
Were you?
Oh, yeah. I couldn't handle fame and fortune. In New York in the 70s, when I started earning a lot of money, you know, I also found oil and gold for countries. You know, the president of Mexico kind of honored me. I found one of the largest offshore oil and I actually got a Mexican passport being honored. And I couldn't handle the success. And
so did you crash?
It was terrible. I would go into restaurants and I would order all the desserts and I would devour everything. But I didn't want to put on weight. So what I did... I remember those movies of the Hellenic and Romans. They used to stick a feather down the throat and go back to feast. And I did the same.
What was it about fame and money that you couldn't cope with?
I just couldn't. It was horrendous.
Part of it?
Well, you see, I wanted to be the Elvis Presleys of the world, the psychic Elvis Presley. I wanted to be the John Lennons. I wanted to emulate those successful superstars. But I couldn't handle it. It was money was pouring in, fame was pouring in. The Studio 54s in New York, the limousines, I was addicted to bulimia. I was absolutely addicted. That was my vice.
So behind all of the gloss of success at that time, were you a lonely, sad figure?
I was not a lonely, sad figure. I was a confused individual because. Suddenly, the attack of success came so fast to me that I just could not handle it. I was wearing three Rolexes. I had dark limousines with mirrored windows. I flew with the helicopters. I wanted everything.
Do you still do that?
No, absolutely not. I totally changed. Look, my jeans are torn.
Why though? Because you've still got lots of money.
Why? I'll tell you why. When I was bulimic and I could not take it, John Lennon and I, we were very close. And one day John looks at me and he says to me, Uri, you know, you look like an Auschwitz survivor. I lost so much weight. I mean, I was like 54 kilos, maybe a little more. I was a walking skeleton. And he said to me, you got to find spirituality. Now, I heard of the word spirituality, but I didn't know what it was. And he said to me, go to Japan and find it. I didn't know why he said Japan, but probably because Yoko. And I was very, very well known in Japan. I did huge TV shows there. While I did the David Dimbleby, everyone after the David Dimbleby, every country wanted to see the same show. And I listened to John go on a plane with my mother, with my wife, with my two children, Daniel and Natalie. They were toddlers, with my brother-in-law.